live. This is Dark Journalist, and everyone, here she is, Dr. Carmen Bolter. How are you, Carmen?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's so great to have you here. Of course, originally, we had you scheduled for Friday night, and then you were in NASA, and you came in, and you were having some amazing difficulties landing. Can you tell me what happened there?
Well, the first thing that happened was we were scheduled for a 10:30 flight, so I got to the airport at 8:45, and we were already at the gate and learned that there had been a plane crash.
Oh.
And the plane crash closed the runway and closed the airport, and they said, we'll give you an update in an hour, and then another hour. And then they rescheduled us for 1:15, and then we got on that plane, and we took off, and then we got to Fort Lauderdale, and we went round and round for an hour and a half.
Oh, my gosh.
On a 35-minute flight.
Oh.
And so they said, well, we're going to run out of gas. We've lost our place in the queue. We'll go back to Freeport and fuel up and then take you back to Nassau. And then they went, no, no, we're going to take you straight back to Nassau. So we land in Nassau, and they say, well, if you get off the plane, they're going to give the plane to somebody else, and you'll have to clear customs again. And so then the air conditioning system went down, so we were all in a sauna. And then they said, oh, we can refuel with you on the plane, okay. So then, okay, let's go. So they pull back from the gate, and then they put the brakes on and say, they literally said, don't freak out, but we're going back to the gate, and we have to reboot, turn the plane off, reboot the operating system. Don't worry, don't worry. So that took, well, 2 hours. And then finally we took off, landed, everything was perfect. They said there was bad weather in Fort Lauderdale. What weather? Didn't see anything. And maybe something happened. I mean, it has been stormy. But so when we got off the plane, all the people who had been waiting for our flight to land at 12, or, well, it would have been earlier than that, but the time to clean the plane and all of that, they were sitting there like, oh. So I was flying with my hostess here, but her husband was on a different flight, and his crew and the person sitting next to us, every single plane got delayed, misguided. It was just really
unbelievable.
So it took us 12 hours to do a 35-minute flight.
Amazing. Carmen, you were right there in the hot zone. You were going to show up on this program live for the first time in 2 years. It just seems like quite a coincidence you had that much of a hassle.
Well, and my friend said, I guess somebody doesn't want you sharing your information. And there was a friend on who was live, said, do you think it has something to do with your research? You know, and it's hard to imagine that anyone would go to any kind of trouble to make that sort of thing go wrong.
Right.
But now everybody thinks that way.
Well, they have a lot of experience. You have a lot of experience.
Pardon me?
You have a lot of experience at these types of things.
Well, yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I do.
We were just talking. We're going to launch into so many interesting things about your new Atlantis documentary, your new website, pyramidcode.online. I want everyone to check this out. We're going to talk about all your new research, but we were discussing the kind of incredible technical hassles that you get when you go to do these projects online and when you go to set them up. I think it's important for people to realize the amount of blocking that takes place and the amount of censorship in the world of these amazing archaeological finds, which after all connect back not only to our ancient history, but sense of identity, sense of consciousness, all these different things.
Well, there does seem to be a real concerted effort to make people less conscious instead of more conscious.
Yeah.
You know, we've been promised ascension and the archangels and all of that kind of stuff they've been talking about that for decades. And it doesn't seem to be happening in the way that we would have anticipated. So, yeah, and all these platforms are literally being hacked. There's no question. You know, and I get a lot of flack from people who say, well, that would never happen to me. Okay. But it does happen to me.
Yeah. Well, let's think about it. The type of material that you work on about our ancient past, whether that's about the real mysteries of Egypt, and you spent so much time there, but that history going back, the Hall of Records aspect around Egypt, the older Atlantis culture, these are a lot of times I don't think people understand they are political hot button issues with geopolitical ramifications. And so you find yourself when you're doing archaeological work, actually in the middle of political intrigue very often.
Well, there's no question about that. I've been a candidate on 5 different expeditions that ended up somehow going sideways with things blowing up and people dying and all kinds of things so that the thing got buried and never came to light. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous amount that goes on with that. But even something like King Tut's DNA and the Department of Antiquities in Egypt, Mzahi, really wanted it to be that Tut was Akhenaten's son, which I don't believe for one split second. And I watched that whole drama go on for 12 years where they had a Japanese team and then they shut them down. And then Scott Woodward from Brigham Young University got involved and they were there with the National Geographic crew and they were just about to drill into King Tut's tooth to get a sample of DNA. And then they went, security, no, and shut it all down. And then National Geographic had all these things about Akhenaten's mummy, which I don't think they're ever going to find either from various reasons. But, and it was a skeleton in the fetal position. But anyway, so I happened to be there on February 17th, 2009, when they did the press conference at the National Museum, and the curator's secretary said, let her in. And so I was standing there listening to Zahi give the report in Arabic, and I went, I'm pretty sure I know what he just said there. And then he said it again in English, and yes, I did hear him right, that it was the medical model, and Tut had a club foot and a hare lip and died of malaria. No, that's not what makes any sense. But if Tut was Akhenaten's father, as much as they've said about Akhenaten being crazy and deformed, it would make him white.
Ah.
In Africa, you know, the Black Madonna, Isis, the whole Western thing wants him to be white. So well, all we have to do is lie about the DNA. Go ahead.
Well, when you get to Akhenaten, I don't even think it's a white-black question. It's a human versus what else kind of question because he's so unusual looking to start with.
Okay, star being whatever, but he does happen to have, well, appear to have white skin, and then they just pull that out and use it to their convenience. And this is going on with Atlantis as well.
Yeah.
And so there's this whole thing called oppositionalism, which I'm starting to understand more about. So a lot of the people in the mystery schools and, you know, and coming down through the Knights Templar and, you know, all of these different traditions wanted to tell their story. And they did say some things about the story. But then they put this clue in that takes you in a complete opposite direction. So you're thinking you're looking in a certain way and you can go look for it there. And they put this huge flaw into the story. And the rest of it is largely correct. But that's standard for any of this stuff.
Right.
You know? And that's the part that people don't understand. They think it's going to be a direct story, and it never is because they wanted the high-level initiates to understand this material, but they didn't want everybody to understand it. So once you hang on and catch on to that and start ciphering through which is the real part and which is the distraction part, then you have more of a chance at getting there. But the only way we're going to be able to really do that is if we've got our own discernment. And that's the last thing they want to teach us in school or model, you know, that you say, there's something wrong with that. I just don't feel right when I hear it, you know, and they say, oh, come on, you're just making stuff up. But if we don't have discernment, what do we have? Sometimes stories go along and you're thinking, yeah, that's pretty good. And then something happens and you have this horrible feeling in your body because basically something is opening you up or shutting you down. And right. it's like a pendulum swings one way or the other. Divining rods crossed for action, open, right? And I think we can train ourselves to be human divining rods, but that wasn't strange at all for the ancient Egyptians. That's what the training was, is to be a human divining rod.
Yes, this would be something that they incorporated as part of their tradition, which we've lost now. And we're deep, deep, deep in the scientific materialism. So we're losing that larger spiritual vision. But Carmen, your work the cover-up, before we get to the cover-up around Atlantis and the Hall of Records and these things, and this new Atlantis documentary series that you're doing, which is absolutely fascinating. I really want to get into that. But the cover-up around Akhenaten and Nefertiti, this is kind of a hallmark in your work also, but there's something very unusual that took place there when they were ruling, including the fact that he moved the capital.
First of all, Amarna is somewhere that was built on fresh land. And yeah, most anywhere else, it was, you know, like you see all these Catholic churches that were built on top of temples of Isis. And so, you know, Amarna is really unique in terms of before anything had a chance to be there. It was just flattened. If you've been there, there's just almost nothing there. Uh-huh. One big pillar from the palace, the Grand Palace. But I mean, but the energy's still there, and what happened there. So if you're, you know, psychically in tune or able to pick up on energy, or if you have cellular memory because you lived there, you know, there's a way to access that information. But this was a really, really big deal because we haven't had peace on the planet since then. And this was a really beautiful situation that didn't have a lot of hierarchical, you know, the who knew and who didn't and all that. It was a really peaceful, creative, collaborative community. And it was beautiful. It was, you know, flowers, trees, chirping birds, everything in harmony. And the Amun priesthood did not like that because right, they were asking people for half their harvest to go to the temple. And then, of course, you had the ceremony of the weighing of the hearts, and you could pay for Horus to hold the scale up so that your heart would look light, and you'd pay for it, which is kind of like Catholic confession.
Right.
And it's known that criminals just love it because they can go to confession and, you know, do a couple of Hail Marys and be done with it.
Right, right. Yeah, that's fascinating about the priesthood. You often say that we get the term amen from this priesthood.
Amun, amen. And that signifies a time period where of darkness.
Yeah.
It's darkness. It's not okay. It's the density. It's the Iron Age, if you will, as opposed to the Golden Age. And it's a time where if you don't get caught, it's not wrong, where corruption is rampant. And we still say amen. I won't say amen because it's just, you know, like when we even say that, amen, like, yay, we got somewhere, we did something, you know. So anyway, I just find it all quite disappointing.
Oh, absolutely. One of the great things that you point out is just how much of an earthquake the rule of Akhenaten and Nefertiti was, and that that's all tied in with Tut in terms of that era and how they kind of installed Tut after they got rid of Akhenaten. And they leveled Amarna. You know, it's almost like a nuclear blast, the way they just got rid of any reference to it. What was it about Akhenaten and Nefertiti's reign that caused them to just want to black it out of history? Carmen, you still there?
I'm still here, but you broke up there just a little bit. So what was it about Akhenaten and Nefertiti's reign that?
It caused the priests to want to wipe it out of history completely, you know, in such a way that, you know, they had, in terms of pharaohs, they had quite an adoration of their pharaohs and thought of them as godlike. But in Akhenaten's case, boom, they just got rid of them. What was it? What was he doing? Why was he such a heretic?
Okay, well, first of all, dynastic Egypt started in 3113 BC with the patriarchal version of Egypt, and the magic and the high spirituality was all pre-dynastic. And in the 18th dynasty, starting with Hatshepsut, the pure stuff started to percolate back up. And so it's almost sure that Akhenaten was the great, maybe five greats grandson of Hatshepsut herself. And so they were remembering. And so if you think about, you know, how the civilizations were, they were telepathic in ancient Egypt. So if you're lying, everybody knows. You can't lie. It just doesn't work. So by densifying everybody, by it's not wrong and by paying other people off, you know, then you can get your way and rob the people. And so Nefertiti and Akhenaten said, no, we're not doing this. And it was a time where they were switching between Thebes and Memphis. And the south cycle of Syria in one location and then in the other. They were afraid that it was going to cause a civil war. And they went, you know what? We don't want to have anything to do with that. And so they didn't go to one god. All these things that they keep repeating and repeating and repeating. But how is that any different than news right now? They repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. And then you're supposed to get it. Oh, it's ISIL. No, it's ISIS. ISIS, 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 ISIS. Well, is there any accident that the crystal altar at Abu Ghraib is the name of their jail? And that the temples of ISIS, being the purest form for the populace that went on well after, you know, the Ptolemaic Egypt, you know, is the name they chose. You know, it's all laughing at what we almost know or don't know to try to smear the difference between corruption and blood from death instead of blood from life. Okay, so during the time that they started Amarna, they did close the temples, and the Amun priesthood couldn't collect the harvest and make money off keeping people ignorant and saying, hey, I'll save you, and then you don't have to worry about it because I got it, you know? So you give me money, and I'll make sure you get to the other side. But the thing is that, you know, the whole Valley of the Kings and everything on the walls of these tombs is, you know, you have to face your enemies. You have to, you know, you're judging yourself. It's not a judgment coming from outside of you. There's the fair witness and there's Thoth who's writing down. But the question is to you, how do you think you did in your incarnation, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what the texts show and, you know, the prophecies and all of that. And so everything got distorted so that people could make money off other people's ignorance.
Right.
And how is that any different than now?
Well, it seems to me that Akhenaten was connected with those spiritual mysteries and something that they were doing. And that's why Akhenaten and Nefertiti show up in this way. There's something about what they were doing, which was revealing it to the larger population of Egypt. So I think that this is something I get from your work a lot, which is something working there, which has an echo now. We can still kind of feel that. And we're still talking about these people some 3,000 years later.
Well, we are. But then with that Nefertiti find, with that the YouTube that you and I did that went viral, and then you see how YouTube counts, because it was up to 120,000 like 3 days in.
Yes.
And then it was down, and then it was below, and then it, you know, crept up by 2,000 or 3,000, and I know how many people were seeing it, and even though I wasn't looking for it, it keeps coming up on my YouTube
feed. Oh, yeah.
But the numbers haven't changed in a year. So, you know, like, those numbers aren't what they think, but I know that that thing went really viral.
Oh, no question. It went off the charts, and it's a fascinating find that really changed history in so many ways. One of the things I want to spotlight about that is just before I found out that you were down there in the hot zone doing some filming, a story from a Turkish, very popular Turkish website, the day after they announced this weird offensive on the Kurds from Turkey and all in Syria, they ran this episode that we did, part one, because we did three episodes on it. They ran it, and it got this incredible spike off the charts from this Turkish website. It was about 10,000 views in a day for a video that was 2 or 3 years old. What was interesting about it was right afterwards, I found out that you were here. So it was like this incredible kismet was going on. But I do find that series, and I'll link it when the video's over in the description, because that series of finds that were in Turkey relating to Nefertiti were quite powerful. And the idea that Egyptian remains would be in Turkey is quite powerful right off the bat. That suggests there was a fleeing that was taking place, or an exile.
I agree. Now, if they're going on about it being one god, and I think just the way we have past life, future, and that if they're going to be telling lies about us, and you have to gather something as you're leaving, what are you going to bring? And so what's in that find?
Yeah.
Characters. And so, but, okay, now I was charging my batteries and they said, wait till Monday before you book, you finalize your flight. And on the Saturday, they kicked all the Americans out of Turkey. And on the Sunday, they opened the border to Syria. Well, that was like the next day. Like, you know, you have to wonder about that. And right. Then now they're doing it again, and there's more of a reaction. But having said that, the treasure hunters scratched away the back of the gold of one of the statues to reveal, and we know that they're wooden statues with gold plating on them or whatever, gold leaf. And they took the wood because you can carbon 14 date wood. And guess what? I think I told you this. It came out at 11,000 years ago. Well, it's got to be older than that because carbon 14 always makes things look younger the older it is.
Right.
And so this means that Nefertiti and Akhenaten didn't make it there. They inherited it.
Yeah.
Just the way you pass down your grandmother's jewels in China.
Right.
Right? And so that is just mind-boggling that Nefertiti and Akhenaten had treasures from a more distant past. Well, what's 11,000 years ago? Atlantis.
Yes.
I mean, there's certain things you just can't argue with.
Well, this is interesting for me, too, because when you look at the traditional dating around Akhenaten, we're looking at somewhere around 1200 BC, somewhere in there.
1300
BC. So some of that carbon dating bringing us back 11,000 BC.
Yeah.
That is 10,000 year missing gap. Suggesting a legacy culture in between.
Okay, but all these dates are kind of slippery. And, you know, the whole precession of the equinoxes is also a little bit malleable. Because they say 25,920, but with the elliptical orbit, then it's 24,000. And so you can't really say because it's a spongy kind of orbit, okay, for one thing. And they don't even know how they that seemed to be longer because there was a change in the frequency of time. And that the Iron Age is so dense that it compresses time in a different way. So all of these things have kind of fallen out of our conversation. We don't really even understand it. But even when somebody says Atlantis was this, and my favorite is there was so much corruption and they were doing all these experiments between animals and humans. And it was so corrupt that God sent a flood. Well, if floods are causative from corruption, what do we have now?
We're overdue for a big flood here.
And all these stories are just piling up and repeated and repeated and repeated and repeated. But then they say, you know, the Atlanteans were patriarchal and the Lemurians were matriarchal and it was this and it was that. But they're not giving any context for how that could be true. But if Atlantis lasted two, if not more, processional cycles, so we're talking, you know, 60,000 years or more, how can you say it was one thing?
Yeah.
It went through its own cycles. It went through its own locations, all these different things. The problem with our understanding of Atlantis is our errors in thinking that our school has given us by the one right answer hypothesis, the banking system of education, you probably heard me say, where the teacher deposits the information into the students and they give it back for credit. It's the same words. Right? So it's not knowing anything. It's not creative thinking. It's not constructivism where you build on what you know. It's not personal development where, you know, you have to be connected to what you're saying. It's just, I have the answer, give it back, and you get your marks. Then you can forget about it.
Right.
And then people can't think straight anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is cognitive dissonance. You say one thing, you say the other, you say the other. And this is Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, who started the notion of public relations. And if they have cognitive dissonance and confuse you, then you stick the commercial in and say, go buy a Big Mac. And people go, okay, you know. And then so people are completely unable to think straight. And I've asked lots of people, what do you think of the current situation of the world? And they all say the same thing, which is astonishing.
What do they say? Right. Carmen, what is it that they say?
I don't know what to think anymore.
Oh, yes.
I don't know what to think anymore. I can't conclude. You hear both sides. You hear the contradiction. And there's even a study that was done on the headline of a newspaper article, and the formula and the last paragraph of any article contradicts the title.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's real misinformation. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. We are here with Dr. Carmen Bolter, and it's great to have you because we were going to have you Friday, and now here you are. Now, you just got back from the CPAC conference, and this is a conference that studies ancient mysteries. So it's a conference of processional and ancient knowledge. This is very exciting that you were there. What were you talking about?
Well, my talk was called The Sacred Cosmology of Ancient Egypt, a Virtual Tour. So I took high-quality pictures that were professionally done of the ceiling of the Temple of Dendereth, the linear zodiac that's 40 feet up. So, you know, if you're standing there trying to look at it, or if you're trying to get your own pictures, it's really difficult to get it. And also, I had a whole series on the Valley of the Kings and what's in the tombs and the storyline and explaining it. Because, again, the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera was like looking into a black cup of coffee, dark like your suit. And Napoleon brought people to do art, but, you know, he reversed things, had things upside down, but you could hardly see anything,
right,
even if you were trying to sketch it because it was so dark. And so they finally cleaned the ceiling, but still everybody was kind of remiss about what it meant. And then in the Valley of the Kings, the guides aren't allowed to speak, but they scramble your head anyway. And no one's supposed to talk in there, and you weren't allowed to take pictures. And then they did this fiasco of, you know, letting people have camera passes for 2 months or something. And then you couldn't buy the ticket. And then the watchman inside the tomb was saying, where's your ticket? Oh, well, then give me your camera. You can buy a ticket from me. And it was just chaos with people screaming at each other, you know, because you're allowed to take pictures and you're not. But because I was there so many times, and then because I went to the Valley of the Queens as well, there was a watchman in there who said to me, you want to take pictures? I said, yes. He says, okay, go ahead.
Wow.
So I ended up with all these pictures that then I was able to interpret, you know. And so when people say, you know, like, find me a book that has, you know, the real information, they don't exist. So that's what I was doing, as I was looking at these things and explaining them in a way that makes sense. Now, before I went, I read a book on all of the zodiac. It's called the Paris Zodiac, which, again, is a misnomer because somebody stole the round zodiac from the Temple of Dendera in another chamber and then put it at the Louvre, and that's where it ended up in the end. You know, and so they had the Who Said Everything About This Thing, big thick book. I read every page of it because I just wanted to know who said what about what, including Champollion, uh-huh, who was 21 at the time working as a professor. But it's all these old, you know, that were smoking cigars in the same speakeasy, literally as Darwin, Champollion, Freud, 1910, there they were. And so every single person said something different about it, but all they needed to say was one word. This is about agriculture. Well, there's thousands of symbols all over the ceiling and all over the walls. It's a zodiac. Okay, what about it? And then the range of, it's 500 years old. No, it's 1,000 years old. Oh, no, it's 1,500 years old. Well, if you have 10 people with 10 answers,
yeah,
you've got anything, you've got nothing.
Right.
But somebody really does describe it in a way that makes sense. Then you go, ah, now that fits with that. And if you look at that, here's other evidence of the same thing. And I've seen that on one of the temple walls. And so if that's what it meant over there, that's, you know what I mean? It takes a long time to put it all together, but I really think I've got it now.
Go ahead. Oh, and tell us what it is.
Well, part of it, the only person that ever made sense was a woman named Svetlana Pavlova, who only speaks Russian, who's in her 80s in St. Petersburg, Russia.
You visited her recently.
I visited her a couple of weeks ago. I've been back-to-back trips here. In my effort to stop traveling, I make everybody laugh because then I end up going back to the airport. I really think I'm stopping, but anyway. But what happened was I got an appointment with her finally, and she said that she had been dreaming about being interviewed by me.
Mm.
So I didn't even know she knew about my work, but it is true that there was a proper Arabic soundtrack for the Pyramid Code, and it aired in Russia over and over. So she was really familiar with my work, but she has a similar story. But anyway, I got this appointment to interview her, and then I found out 3 days before the trip that she had had a massive stroke and was going to be in the hospital for 4 weeks. And so I thought, well, you know, I'm bringing my camera. Maybe we go to the hospital and bring her flowers and get an establishing shot and find some of the material she has and translate it. But I still feel that, you know, she really understands something. So didn't she get up and walk out of the hospital a couple of days later?
Wow.
And invited me and my crew over to her house and a translator. And so we had three cameras and we did, you know, a full interview translating what she was going to say. And I already knew some of her material, and I just digitized now a DVD of her having two different articles about this subject translated into English, because her book is all Russian.
Right.
But she said to me, you know, she wants me to help her translate this book. And she put her hands on my arm and leaned forward and said, "And I can't die until you do it."
Oh, my. Wow.
And I got the pictures that go with it, because she doesn't have the good quality pictures. But anyway, so I figured out some of it myself, and I feel really connected to all of this from a cellular level. So when I was listening to her, you know, the first thing she wanted to do was sit down at the computer and show us all these apparitions in her pictures from Egypt that were a good long time ago when she had gone with a girlfriend. And of course, looking around her flat in St. Petersburg, you know, it's Egyptian this and that and this and that. She had a Hathor candle on her table, which I smiled to, just like it sits by my computer.
You're like, "Hey, that looks familiar."
Yeah, no, everything was familiar about it. And, you know, she had a real sense, you know, like, and there we were, you know, it, you know, with the translator in between us. But like halfway through, we were sending each other pictures telepathically. And, you know, we said, "Oh, the translator can talk to the crew because we got it now. We can communicate with each other." So there were a few key things that I wanted to verify by asking the translator. And so I said, "Look, it seems to me like you must have been there." And she had explained first how she had become an engineer. And then she was and I don't know if this is lost in translation, but it's something like astrophysicist. And then she ended up being a professor at a university. And her family was all upset with her because they wanted her to, you know, knit socks and make cake for the grandbabies, you know, and babysit. And all she wanted to do was this work. And so she was totally riveted about the ceiling for a number of years, as I understand it. And she made a template that fit with these decans. And the Egyptians had 3 10-day weeks. And we know that from Kamumbo, where they had the full calendar. And then when there was a big earth event, the axis of the earth that used to be straight was knocked off by 23.5 degrees. And then they had to add 5 days, you know, to the calendar instead. And because it used to be 360 days, which sounds like Mayan stuff. Mm. Anyway, so she made this template and she was following what she understood through her engineering and her astrophysics. And I'm like, wait. It sounds to me like she became an astrophysicist and an engineer because of what she already knew, because I've seen that over and over again. Like when you see a child protege and they're 4 years old and they can play Beethoven or they can play concert piano, well, they used to play it in another life. I mean, it needs to make sense. Like if you're good at something and you have, they call it talent, but I think you've spent a whole life doing it. And so she was coming here with the memories.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, you know, maybe you weren't the person actually making the what's on the ceiling. But do you think you could have had something to do with designing it? And she said, "Oh, yes, I do," she said. You know, and she said, "I know I was there." And I'm like, and you know, and she's looking at me and I'm like, "I know I was there too." Like whatever that means in terms of our passion that we can know of and why these things matter so much to us. And how many people go, "Who cares about that?
Yeah, right.
Why would that matter to you?" But the big clincher here is I looked at her and I said, "Okay, Svetlana, if you think you were there and you think you had something to do with masterminding this design, tell me this. Were you a man or a woman? And she said, I was a woman, of course. Because everything at Dendera was all about the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And
dancing
and all that stuff. So the men came along and they didn't want, you know, the feminine to have anything to do with childbirth, as men tend to do, like the Greeks. And so they had this midget, you know, that they made the patron saint of childbirth. So you don't even need a womb to do that. Right? So anyway, it goes on like that. So all over the ceiling that I already saw are four wings on various beings, four heads of a goat looking in four directions, all these different combinations of three and four. There's the Nui are, it's extremely complex. So whatever I say about it, without looking at the pictures, you're going to get a little bit of it.
Sure.
But Nui is stretched over with her feet in the hieroglyphic for plasma and her hands. And there's one on one side of, it's a huge hypostyle hole, and one on the other. And so everything on the ceiling is cosmology. Everything on the walls is terrestrial. It's saying something about the earth. And it's going through all these cycles of time, the short ones and the long ones. But basically, there are empty decants. And I've come across this prophecy over and over again, at least three different places, which, you know, prophecies from Atlantis are quite obscure, if you can imagine. Oh, yeah. And the prophecy is, when the head of the crab hits the heart of the lion, there will be a major earth catastrophe. Well, what does that mean? That means when the constellation of Cancer crashes into the constellation of Leo, which are beside each other. But if you look at the ecliptic around, you know, the Milky Way and the solar system, the astrological ages don't collide. So well, what are they talking about and what happened?
Wow.
Well, so there we were, and I mentioned this to her, and she says, oh, yes, but that wasn't Atlantean. It was Mayan. But in my third-party hypothesis, the whole idea that the Mayans didn't talk to the Sumerians or the Egyptians or the Chinese or the Indians, the East Indians, but they all share astrology, sacred geometry,
right.
You know, cosmology, it goes on, commerce, systems of weights and measures, pyramid building.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're all doing their thing and they all had similar ancestors. So where'd the Mayans get it? They probably got it from the Atlanteans, because some of these references to this particular, proverb, prediction, premonition, Atlantean, Mayan. I mean, to me now, that doesn't make any difference.
I see.
It could have been passed down.
Right.
Okay. So all of this stuff is very, very satisfying. But she calls the round zodiac, she said, she doesn't call it the round zodiac. She calls it the calendar of catastrophes.
Mm.
So we know that it's 3 feet thick and some dude from somewhere, you know, decided he was going to steal it. And kept the Egyptian authorities away. But they didn't care about that. Like, the Egyptians didn't really care about the pyramids or the temples. It meant nothing to them. So if somebody wanted to go and, you know, pay off the guards, I mean, they chiseled this thing. It took them months to get it out. And then once they got it out, it was so heavy, they're trying to wheel it and slide it and roll it down to a boat, and then the boat started sinking. And then they left a big hole in the ceiling. You know, I mean, it's just so rude. I mean, it's out and out theft.
Now, am I correct in assuming that Dendera is also where they found that incredible stela with the hieroglyphics that look very much like a tank and a helicopter? No, where is that?
That's how it is.
Now, can you talk about that for a moment?
Pardon me?
Can you talk about that stela for a moment, what you think about that?
Well, let's say this first, that Abydos and Dendera are usually off the schedule for cruise ships because it's so far. And that means that they're far away from the Nile. So if you subscribe to the idea and the pyramid code, the temples almost assuredly would have been by the Nile. And if they're far away from the Nile now, they're older. Okay. The Nile migrated and the temple stayed where it was. And so I think that I made a pretty strong case for that in the pyramid code.
Yes.
And so Abydos and Dendera are the oldest temples, but both of them have a temple underneath, which is older. And so at Dendera, they're on top of each other. But in Abydos, they're side by side, but it's the Osirian, which you've heard of, which is now closed because a couple walked on the floor, got permission to walk on the floor and went into one of the chambers and made whoopee. So they closed the everybody. So on next trip, I've already applied for special permission for the group to walk on the floor, but they can't give us permission till closer to the group, which is in March. And also this time, just as an aside, instead of taking this huge long day on a coach, we will be sailing there.
Oh, we'll fascinating. Yeah, you mentioned that.
And so, pardon me?
You've done so many tours now to Egypt, and you've lived there, of course. And I want to talk about that, too. This tour, I just want to say, I found very fascinating because you're calling it the sailing tour. So you're actually incorporating the sailing into the whole thing.
Well, usually we do a four-day cruise on a commercial cruise ship that won't stop at the decidedly feminine temples. And as I said, you know, if you're going to go to these special temples, you got to sit on a bus for a whole long, long day.
Yes.
It's a big 12-hour day to do that, which is tedious and difficult. So this time I have chartered 2 10-room boats on our own sailboats. Can you imagine the photo ops with 2 boats going down? And it's ours, so we can do yoga, we can do presentations, we can do whatever we want. They serve smoothies for breakfast and vegan whatever.
That's great.
So we got the boat to ourselves, and once we're on it, the captain goes where we say and stays as long as we stay. But that means that we'll be approaching these major temples when the cruise ships have come and gone. Because most of the time, those temples are just super crowded, shoulder to shoulder, and then nobody's right there for the rest of the day. Right. So a lot of the special experiences that I've had at those temples have been by myself when I go, you know, when no one else is there.
Yes.
And I've been doing tours for 24 years, and this is the first time I've been able to secure, you know, such a possibility.
What are the dates, Carmen, for this tour? And people can find information about this tour at pyramidcode.online.
It's March 8th to 21st. It's under the icon of trip.
Okay.
And it's got the full confirmed schedule and all what's included and what isn't. And the way to register is linked to my email address, and I'll register people in person. So, and pyramidcode.online is where I had parked the site when I was making it, and now it's migrating over to pyramidcode.com. It'll stay where it is on Pyramid. But I don't know if you just Google Carmen Pyramid, like most people usually find me, it'll come up just yet. But
got it. I found it. Actually, I went to pyramidcode.online, and it is all there right now. It's a great looking site, and the information is there. March 8th to 21st, 2020, Magic Egypt sailing trip. This sounds fantastic. And I want to recommend that people who think they might be interested in doing this should go for it, because these things sell out quickly. And once you're at maximum, that's it.
Well, that's true, because of these, the boats have a limited number of rooms. But yes, the other thing is that we get 2 hours inside the Great Pyramid by ourselves on Equinox.
Oh, that's fantastic.
On the last day. Yeah. So that's pretty special.
How many, years, you, when you were living in Egypt, actually, you lived, you called the center you were in the Hall of Records, is that right?
The Hall of Records Retreat Center.
Yes.
My friend and I built this place that was a 2-story flat that slept 12 and that had a rooftop that was right on top of the Giza Plateau. So wow. It was adjacent to the Third Pyramid. But with your camera, even if you got to the very back corner of the thing, you could almost not get the whole Giza Plateau in because you were right there on it, practically.
Wow.
On Fayed Street, and Princess Di's Dodi Fayed is one of the cousins, and at the end of the British occupancy, all the land around the Giza Plateau was given to the Fayed family, and Dodi and his father went first to Alexandria and then to London, but there's 2,000 cousins, and my friend is one of those cousins, and that's how I ended up with that property and being able to renovate it and turn it into the center.
Absolutely incredible. This name, Hall of Records, echoes back to the Edgar Cayce readings about an Atlantean Hall of Records underneath the right paw of the Sphinx. Now, a lot of the Cayce's readings and the prophecies around Atlantis have come true with things like finding the Bimini Wall, for example. And this idea that the Atlanteans hid these records in 3 places, how do you see the Hall of Records now? And do you think that there's any opportunity for archaeologists or researchers like yourselves to uncover it there in Egypt?
Well, pardon me for laughing. First of all, he said the left paw.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a whole thing about the way linguistics works, prepositions under, beneath, beneath and in front of. These are part of these oppositional tricks. In, at, on. Chinese people sit in a chair. We sit on a chair. But this makes a big difference in terms of understanding these prophecies. And I'm almost certain that even through a channeled message, that there would be a little thing that would make you look the other way. Mm-hmm. And so there have been research studies sort of done. Zahi allowed, when John Anthony West and Boris Sayed in the first place went, they drilled a borehole beside the left paw and they stuck this whatever probe down it. But this was back in 93, I think, way back. And then they had a sledgehammer and a plate with this dial, and they hit the sledgehammer on the plate and the dial went up. And, well, to me, that doesn't sound very sophisticated. You know? And yes, there's probably something. I know there's something down under there. There are a network of chambers. I spent a lot of time inside the Sphinx by myself. I mean, I've never brought anybody down in there.
Uh-huh.
And I have pictures from 1910, I think, ironically, because that's a year I mentioned earlier about Darwin and all of them, where there was a temple. There is a temple of Isis under there. And it's a photograph of a temple beside the left flank. And this is drawn out in one of the animations in the Pyramid Code. So again, beneath, but the water from the Nile would have, you know, it started percolating up and they thought that they were digging there and they were gonna find something. No, they were putting sandbags because the Nile was percolating up because that's the original riverbed. And that speaks very well to the theory inside the Pyramid Code. And so, and the high-level initiates would arrive on a barge right there in front of the Sphinx temple, the Valley Temple was there, and then a temple of Isis.
Right.
So what did Zahi do? He paved over the whole thing. So no one can get it.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
And we're talking about Zahi Hawass, who was the Supreme Antiquities Chief and also became part of the corrupt government that was there, the Mubarak government. And he was part, they put him on a cabinet level, which I see this Hall of Records from the Atlanteans becomes very important.
But they didn't make sure to block it so no one would find it, to claim that he was looking for it. And then he was really invested in hiding it. So yeah. What do you believe? I mean, politicians, what do you believe?
Absolutely. Well, what's fascinating there is that Hawass had spent all this time. You know, the Casey Foundation had tried so hard to find the Hall of Records in earnest. And there were people, I think, like Hawass, who were kind of harvesting them as well. And a lot of these people who came out of the Casey Foundation, like Mark Lehner and Hawass, who got all this support from the ARE, they go back and they're looking for the Hall of Records. They're tuned into the Casey readings. But on the surface, they say, oh, that's a bunch of New Age gobbledygook. There's none of that. There's no truth in any of that.
Let me explain. Mark Lehner from the Oriental Institute in Chicago, who I've had interactions with online, not in person.
Uh-huh.
He was part of that. And Robert Boval, who lives 20 minutes down the road from me in Spain, and Graham Hancock were writing about this. And Mark was with them on it. And Zahi went to him and said, I will make you the second most famous archaeologist on the planet if you drop them.
Oh, yeah.
Gave him the pyramid builders dig, so-called pyramid builders dig. Basically, there were workers and bread-making and beer-making equipment, but it doesn't prove that they built anything.
Right.
But then he got locked into that as his project and never said another word about the Hall of Records. Okay, having said all that, when I say beneath and in front of,
oh, I think we got a video freeze. Are you back with us? I think we may have lost Carmen, everyone out there. You're watching the Dark Journalist Show. We have Carmen Bolter here with us, and we've been doing pretty well with our connection up to now. It's possible we may have to reboot it. So Carmen, if you can hear me, literally you can shut down from this session and relink in there. We're going deeply into Carmen's travels to Egypt, and it's an amazing journey that she's had throughout her life, some four decades of spending this time finding the real story. Her fascinating series on Netflix, which is called The Pyramid Code. This is a five-part series which explores aspects that just aren't looked at by other Egyptologists. And she's using things in there, being a PhD from the University of Calgary, that are scientific in one sense, and then also bringing in all this intuition and that aspect of it. So this is very important tools that she's utilizing there. I think we have her back. Let's take a look. Carmen, you're back.
I don't know where I went, but I know I was saying something.
There's no question about it. Okay. It's great to have you back. It certainly is true, as we're getting into the Hall of Records and the kind of power play that takes place when people take over the Giza Plateau and control these things. And you were talking about how Zahi Hawass, who at the time was connected and was the head of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, which is kind of one of those names. It just sounds like the grand poobah of everything. But he basically controlled that plateau. And so we have this figure, Mark Lehner, who actually was someone that the ARE, the Casey Foundation, had sponsored his education. And he actually wrote a book about the Sphinx and Casey's readings on the Sphinx and the Hall of Records. And so for him to become then the major block against people like Schock and people like Hancock is quite interesting to me.
Well, of course it is. But now, like, when you start linking all these stories together, it's their playbook. Mm-hmm. Say one thing and do something else, and say you're encouraging it and then block it somehow. I mean, that's the game they're playing. I mean, I think they keep repeating it over and over and over again in different ways, you know, including false flags and everything else and political everything. I mean, I think by now we all can see through it. But my point is that if it's beneath and in front of, which is just adjusting prepositions, which is how all languages have a different set of preposition, you know, in terms of their sense of space and all of that. So they mean different things in different languages, which is why it's difficult for students who speak another language to learn English, because they get those words wrong, because their language doesn't function in the same way. I mean, I have a PhD in linguistics, so I understand that.
I just mentioned your PhD in the break there, so now we're in sync.
Okay, so beneath and in front of, what's right in front of the Sphinx? If you go, you know, down the Nile a little bit, it's not right in front of, it's okay, far kilometers, but Hawara. Like, when we did the geoscans, there's all kinds of chambers on two different levels that don't connect like snakes and ladders. They're complete, like, older is deeper. So there's a deeper layer, you know, and the ceiling is 40 meters from the surface, which is far. The other one's 20 meters. And there's all kinds of things in these chambers. And they're huge chambers. But they did a scan for gold. They did a scan for precious jewels. And they're finding. Now, we haven't been allowed to go and actually verify it, because the Department of Antiquities will not allow anybody to go and verify it.
Wow.
But the thing is that the more things for other, they don't use it for oil and gas, so they can, but they don't want to support the old way. But when they looked for underwater rivers in California, they found them with this technology. So when I first got involved, it was brand new, or new enough that there wasn't a lot of verification. But in the years since we did that, pretty much everything they go and actually dig, they find in the right spot what they were looking for. And
so fascinating.
Okay, so that was fascinating.
This would be like space archaeology, where they're utilizing these kind of satellites to look down and bore down into what's under there.
And it's live satellite feed with logarithms applied to each element. So they do one scan for water, one scan for precious metals, one scan for pottery. And of course, they didn't find any pottery down there or bones. So it was almost like some kind of storage facility. And that's the sort of thing with Göbekli Tepe. They didn't find people or pottery or anything there, or animal bones or anything like that. Okay. And so, yeah, there's a lot to be said for this kind of technology. And let me say something else. They're doing that scan pyramid project. And the last two times, because I've been going to Egypt every 6 months, and we have had time in the pyramid every time alone. And the scan pyramid project's equipment is in there. Now, I was asked to debunk to analyze their data and look at their videos and whatnot. And I'm trained, you know, in teaching quantitative research methods to PhD and master's students sitting on the committee. And if they don't do their research properly in their methodology, they don't get their PhD.
Right.
You know, when you're a supervisor or you're on the committee and it's not academic, you know, research style, they have to fix it or they don't get their PhD. Okay. So I'm trained at looking at how the methodology is. So I looked at all their stuff. And they had these bubble plots, scatter plots, they call them. And every angle had the chamber in a different place and a different size. So what they're speculating is that there's a chamber as big as the Grand Gallery beside it in a place in the pyramid. Well, okay, first of all, we have to look at pyramid technology, pyramid power, and how it works. And the essence of it is there's a double helix around quartz crystal. And there's quartz in granite, and it's the pressure. It's pressure. Quartz crystal under pressure, plus water underneath, chambers underneath. It's three different chambers that are positioned in a way that makes it like a resonance chamber. And it doesn't really matter what the angle is, because each pyramid has a different angle. I'm backwards on my camera here. And so theoretically, it doesn't make sense that there would be another chamber as big as the Grand Gallery, okay? But what they're showing with their scatter plots is not the same. Every time they do a scan, it's different. It's showing it in a different place. It's showing it as a different densification, and they're going, yay, we did it. And they're also showing how they're talking about what's going on inside the pyramid, and they're using drone footage from outside, which has nothing to do with what's inside.
Oh.
All of that.
Why are they getting these different reads?
Well, because the LIDAR technology isn't accurate. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but they are publishing. And I went into their real peer-reviewed journals and looked at their pictures and all that stuff. Okay, so maybe I'm right and maybe I'm wrong. But if you just look at those scatter plots, and somebody had that at CPAC. And people say, oh, yeah, it's the same. They had the different ones. Where there's a whole lot of things and it looks wide. And then there's a few little ones that's down, and they say, and then they've got the Grand Gallery beside it. And it's like, it's not the same thing.
Oh.
Now there's reasons why they would find energetic anomalies in there, mm-hmm. but that does not mean it's a cavity. Okay. A. B. They say at the bottom of the last few words, sentences of the articles, the peer-reviewed journal articles, even if they concluded that there was a chamber, the Department of Antiquities would unequivocally never let them drill to send a camera through to see.
So what's the point, right?
Well, is anybody noticing that?
Yeah.
To me, that's the most important point.
Right.
No matter what your data shows, we're never going to verify it. Verifiability is the whole thing. As I said before, you can get your hypothesis from a past life or from a dream, but you have to verify it. And if you can't verify it, you don't have anything. Right. Period.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
It is funny, but people just let the researchers talk, and they say, and we found it and everything.
You know? There's no question. And what's amazing to me, well, I think the Himara and the Labyrinth is one of the most exciting finds, and you're at the very heart of that. One of the things, I want to go into this complex for a minute, though, the Giza Plateau. Now, in some of those Casey readings regarding the Giza Plateau, he says this, that when they originally set it up, his dating, 10,500 BC, which agrees with some of the things that Hancock and some of the others have found, and the weathered watering that Robert Schock found on the Sphinx, which was because of rains, apparently, that the Nile had, you know, they had in Egypt there in around 10,000 BC. And so that weathered watering caused quite a stir, but they shut that down. But he was a geologist, of course. So coming in with just hard facts, and archaeology is like, we don't want to deal with those hard facts. But that would put the dating around 10,500 BC. Now, Casey said when they set them up originally, that the people who set them up, the Egyptians / Atlanteans, were doing archaeology themselves. So Carmen, how old is this site of Giza? If in 10,500 BC they find it because they're doing archaeology.
Exactly. Okay. But the thing is that we're looking at it in the wrong way. We're you know, like if the alignment of Leo rising in front of the nose of the Sphinx, which is what the equinoxes are, okay? Right. So it's 14 degrees for winter solstice in the Grand Causeway in front of the Second Pyramid and 14 degrees in front of the Great Pyramid, which is basically showing solstices and equinoxes. And then the large cycles of time, and they show Orion and the, you know, and now, just as an aside, Robert Bovall's theory of Giza being Orion has been unequivocally verified by independent archaeoastronomers that have, that never mention his name, that have found that more than one person, peer-reviewed journal. It was 30 years after Robert made this speculation.
Wow.
Okay. That now I've seen the paper. He showed it to me last time I saw him on the Costa del Sol where I now live. And so this is not a question anymore. This isn't a hypothesis anymore. Okay.
So let's clarify what that is.
And proven. Pardon?
And we'll clarify what it is, which is that the layout of the pyramids are laid out according to the belt of Orion in the sky.
That's right. And it maintains that over time. There is a zenith and a lower point, but even at CPAC, somebody said, no, no, it's that sometimes, but sometimes it's Cygnus. But I know that Cygnus is connected to another pyramid site, and it's just too easy to say, I know what it is, I know what it is. Like, we really have to verify it. Okay,
yes.
Okay, now, if this lines up in 10,500, now, people get mixed up. 10,500 years ago, 10,500 BC, it gets all slippery in there, right, in terms of talking about it, because then that makes it 9,500, and when was the sinking of Atlantis, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But if there's, and they're saying 2450 BC, which somebody tapped me on, somebody was talking 2450 BC, and I was sitting in front of them, and my finger went like this, and they tapped me on the shoulder, and they said, do you think you can get them to change that date? Because there's still people who are repeating the date that makes no sense, that doesn't add up, that we've shown over and over again. So getting back to the answer of your question, if it aligned in 10,500 or 11,600 or whatever, if the Younger Dryas hit, da, 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 and we had the world flood that was coming along, you don't go build a pyramid then.
Right.
But it's aligned. So if we have the precession of the equinoxes, and if that was in, you know, general curriculum and people understood that we aren't 5,000, 6,000 years old, the Bible wants us to be that.
Right.
The Quran wants us to be that. It doesn't mean that's what we are. And that's the patriarchal time frame. So the agenda of the patriarchy is to erase evidence of everything other than itself. Okay, so forget that. And okay, so if you have 10,500 or whatever, and you add 24,000 or 25,000
years,
well, added that again. Okay, so Hakim, the indigenous wisdom keeper in the pyramid code, is comfortable with the pyramids being 50,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, unified ground plan, we know that. But what was put there? Well, I've also shown the pyramid code that it looked like the platforms were there with other buildings before they put the pyramids there, and that fits with what I know from past life stuff. So we just have to allow our brains to stretch farther back so that we can imagine. But the pyramids age and the temple age are completely different times. The older temples that are deeper at Abydos and Dendera are completely different times.
Mm-hmm.
The migration of the Nile. Okay, and so everybody wants to swish it together. But why? It doesn't fit. It doesn't explain anything. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, one of the things about the pyramids is that, you know, some people say there's an inverted pyramid underneath and they're Merkabahs. No, there is a slight shallow angle in the base of the pyramids before the construction. Okay. And the purpose of that is when all the blocks get on, if things get smash-oled, if you get an earthquake, if you get tsunamis, a world flood, what happens is the blocks get closer and tighter. Mm. So they can survive all this. That's the point. It's a state, the base of, you know, smaller and smaller and smaller. Those are very stable structures. That there's now people talking about how if you put a knitting needle through the Great Pyramid and come out the other side, you come out at Haleakala. And there's people talking about most of the pyramids on the volcano on the other side. Yes?
Wow.
And it's about stabilizing the planet. Now, if we go back to Atlantis and the whole idea, one of my first past life reading, the reader said, just a minute. He's looking around. He goes, just a minute. And then he goes, oh, my God, you've got 40 guides. He says, I've been doing this for a long time. I've never seen that. Anyway, so then he goes into the reading, and he said that I was on an evacuation committee in Atlantis when there was foreknowledge of another Earth catastrophe coming. Okay? Mm. Now, Paula Violette talks about 58,000 years ago, 108, whatever. But, you know, and now Graham Hancock has gone deep into Younger Dryas, a 1,000-year period of you know, the ice age, flooding, and there's a number of different scientists. I think it's 75. I just recently interviewed Graham Hancock at his home in Bath. And, okay, so that is now, just like with this Orion mystery, that is now confirmed. There's right. No arguing that. It's not speculative. It's not.
And that is that there's a comet strike somewhere about 12,000 years ago.
Well, that there's an Earth flood.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's for sure what caused it.
Uh-huh.
There was an ice age and something interrupted that, and then everything melted, and then the flash of the animals in the middle of eating, and you know, and they're extinct.
Right.
But everybody didn't die. Okay. But there were other catastrophes, and if we subscribe to the idea of a golden age where they were smarter and had technology, of course they had technology. What makes us think we're the only ones with technology? What makes us think we're smart now? We're not smart now. We're ruining the planet. But anyway, so could there have been something predictive? And there
we're
are
the most
things.
Advanced culture that's ever been, Carmen. What do you mean?
Well, I find that lots of things don't make people very smart.
You think that's pretty debatable.
Well, anyway, but the point of the matter is that we're too quick to judge that they didn't know what they were doing. Okay, so it seems that the decision was that different groups from this Atlantean period were going to go. They were a worldwide seafaring culture. They knew how to desalinate water. They knew how to grow sprouts and whatnot on. They didn't have scurvy. They were growing the fruits and vegetables right on the boats. I mean, it's documented. There's various people, you know, who have been able to figure this out. Okay, so they sent different groups to different places, okay? But they chose the groups. And I've given this example, and it may seem silly, but, you know, the firemen went over there, and the ballerinas went over there, and the hip-hop guys went over there. So they all dress different, and they have different music and different headdresses and different styles. And they sent them with each other, which would make sense.
Right.
Right? Because they're already a little community, and they all have their skills and whatnot. And they said, so they ended up being the Mayans, the Chinese, and I gave the list of five before, the Sumerians. They all had this advanced knowledge. They all had similar things. Okay, but the other thing, I mean, there's, I won't be able to tell you all of it, but where would Grand Central Atlantis have been if they had endured an ice age? And how would that work? And just the way King Tut, you know, they wanted him to be white. Well, guess what? They want Atlantis to be Western.
Mm.
They want it to be Bimini, the Atlantic Ocean, Santorini. Okay, if Atlantis went down and disappeared, swallowed up, how can it be Santorini? It's still there.
That's right.
Okay,
No, this is always, Santorini's always the easy one because Plato's over there in Greece and they're like, hey, Santorini's over here. It was destroyed by a volcano. So that's always the easy way to sum it up. But Atlantis is a lot older, of course.
And it's in the Atlantic. Okay, let's work with that for a minute. When you go into space and look at the Earth, you don't see United States, Canada, Russia, China. You don't see a pink country and a blue country. It's the Earth.
Right.
The ancients didn't say Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian Ocean. It was one world ocean. Where are you going to put the boundary? We made that up. We put it on a map.
Right.
It's one world ocean. It was called the Atlantic. That doesn't mean that if you go on the other side of the world, they didn't think of it as the Atlantic. And again, the oppositionalism, look over there, look over there. No, we want it to be Western. Then the Greeks get to say, okay, that doesn't mean that Bimini didn't have a lot going on, that whole thing, the Bermuda Triangle. It was a worldwide seafaring culture. Let's go back to the one right answer hypothesis that the teacher has. A, B, C, D, A is the answer. Why can't it be more than one place? Why can't Atlanteans have been on the high altiplano of South America, Antarctica, Troy, okay? And so we have Danny Irwato, who made this beautiful chart, and he's got all the places that people have said where Atlantis could have been and all the characteristics of what Plato said Atlantis had.
Mm-hmm.
Exotic wood, three growing seasons, a pattern of three rivers that joined, rectangular landmass with mountains around, elephants, aromatherapy, coconuts, it goes on. Like, and I'm interested, what did they eat? What did they do? Who were they? What? Wow. How did they entertain themselves? What were their sports events like? What was a festival? I want to know all of that,
yeah.
Okay? And I'm on it. But what people do when they're doing and I've watched them over and over, you know, you're doing a documentary on Atlantis and they say, oh, that was Santorini. And then they go, oh, there were no elephants. Well, then Atlantis is a myth, goes back into the garbage pail of myth.
Mm-hmm.
And then they make something up like Plato was really upset because his mentor, you know, committed suicide or was poisoned or whatever. So he was so upset, he made up this story.
Right.
And then the show's over.
Yeah.
Don't do that to people.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And then people go, oh, it's a myth. Oh, it's a myth. It's a myth. It's a myth. But why is everybody so preoccupied with it? And why is your audience so curious about this? Because we can't leave it alone.
Right.
Because there's a time when we had sanity, we had abilities, we had telepathy, we understood how the world worked, and we were nice to each other.
Huh.
That's a big threat. You know, and blood from life, what's matriarchy? The highest form of DNA is menstrual blood. You get a baby out of it.
Ah.
And then when the patriarchs took over, they're still wearing the red, white, and black. And they're like, oh, we need blood. Let's just slit the neck of a goat or whatever.
Right.
How is blood from death the same thing as blood from life?
Interesting. Yeah. Wait,
let's just get this point straight.
Now you, this is fascinating, actually. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist show. We're here with Dr. Carmen Bolter going deep. She's putting together this new Atlantis documentary series for next year. Our previous series, The Pyramid Code, just really changed things for a long time, or how people viewed Egypt and how you could research those things from a mystical angle with a scientific grounding, which I think is very important in this kind of psychic archaeology that takes place. One of the things I want to ask you, Carmen, is you're there, you're in Nassau, you were shooting down there in the Bahamas. Of course, we've done so many episodes on the hot zone. And a lot of that, your presence down there is very interesting to me. Do you want to tell us what you were doing down there?
Well, first of all, it was my third time in the Bahamas. I spent a lot of time on Abaco.
Yes.
And Bimini.
How's it going down there?
Footage. And in the New Atlantis, there's footage of dolphins on the Bimini Road underwater.
Wow. Incredible.
And beautiful. And okay, so let's just take a few steps here. The Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge was originally the story of the Yuga cycles, Plato's great year. Walter Cruttendon founded it, and he has the Binary Research Institute, and looking at how Sirius has a companion star, and big cycles of time, and some, you know, things that, that we're not getting fed on the mainstream media. But it was Yogananda, autobiography of a yogi that the Beatles got involved in, and Sri Yukteswar was his guide. And so they talk about these big cycles and how we know about it. But Craig Marshall, for example, who was just funnier than funny, had spent 30 years as a monk who meditated 100,000 hours, and then he came out really funny because he the world doesn't add up like you think. But these are the people that started that conference. Okay, full stop.
See, I act strange when I meditate just 10 minutes a day, never mind 100,000 hours. But
think about that. Okay, so, and I am thinking about that. Okay. All right, so Paradise Island has this enormous complex called Atlantis with 9 hotels.
Yes.
But the border of it, okay, the property border of it borders a Shivananda ashram.
Oh.
So Swami Shivananda, and I lived in 2 ashrams in India. I took sannyas. I was fasting and doing yoga in 1970, whatever, you know, and when everybody thought I'd lost my mind, but now it's, you know, when yogurt and yoga were weird, but they aren't anymore. And so my friend, who's my childhood friend, where I'm in her home right now, but I started babysitting her when she was 3, and she moved here to Fort Lauderdale, and her husband has a project building a 20,000 square foot house in Nassau. And so when I first said I was going to go to the Bahamas after CPAC, because they bought me one extra city as part of my ticket, I will go over to the Bahamas. And everybody went, you can't go to the Bahamas. I'm like, why? It's gone. Every single person said, what? You don't watch the news? The Bahamas isn't there anymore.
Wow.
You can't go there. And they were absolutely adamant and completely.
This is all Hurricane Dorian stories.
Yeah. There's 700 islands in the Bahamas. Grand Bahama is one of them, with Freeport. And in my story at the beginning, I said they wanted us to land at the Freeport Airport, which means the Freeport Airport is still there.
Right.
One island got smashola'd, Abaco, where I've been. And it's not a very big island. So when they had all those pictures of the Tinderbox, this is what they do on the news. They have the newscaster and Grand Bahama and people saying, oh, you can smell death. They're saying 60 people died. Well, a lot of the people were illegals from Haiti and all that, and they don't have a name, and who knows why. Mm. But the locals will tell you 5,000 or 6,000 people died. So first of all, they're telling you the Bahamas are underwater, and then they're telling you that 60 people died.
Mm.
Well, the news never tells us the truth.
Right, right.
I got ridiculed because I was going there, and so we flew back and forth over. You heard my story.
Yeah.
We were over Andros. We saw the whole of the Bahamas. We landed. We came back up. I've got footage coming as we landed. All the houses are there.
Fantastic.
I asked all the locals what happened. Were you worried? And apparently, you know, the seawalls aren't that high. And so some waves came over and there was a little bit of sand on the road. Nothing happened. There wasn't a branch down. They could have happened. And here, we're at Lighthouse Point, and they were afraid, and they evacuated their daughter and all of that, and everybody got their boats out of the water and got them to dry land, and, you know, everybody was nervous that it could happen, and nothing happened.
Wow, incredible.
One island got smashed. Half of another island called Grand Bahama had trouble. Like, Nassau's on Providence Island or something like that. It's not Grand Bahama.
Mm-hmm.
But people globalize. How many times have I been to Egypt and people tell me it's dangerous when I come back and I was there the day before? How many people come to Egypt with me and go, what problem? But they keep repeating it and repeating it and repeating it.
Mm.
So I got told I was crazy and that the Bahamas was gone.
Wow.
So many times that I thought, well, here we go, system buster. I'll go see for myself.
Fascinating.
Okay. Back to the border and the Shivananda ashram. He had a student, and the student came and went meditating in the jungle, and there was this rock, and he sat on this rock, and I got footage of the rock, and he had a vision of a temple with priestesses underneath where they were, right there with the rock. So they literally built a temple around the rock, and the rock is at the base of the altar. So that whole teaching and all this Indian and the yoga cycles and, you know, all of that is all connected. Okay, and people think that yoga started in India, but my information is yoga started in Egypt. But it also doesn't matter whether it was a Mayan prophecy or, you know, yoga was here or there.
Right.
I think it's all Atlantean.
Absolutely.
It doesn't matter.
Yes.
We say it's here. No, it's here. No, it's here. Where is it? It's all the places they said.
Yeah, yeah.
But not all at the same time. And. I mean, there's more similarities between these sacred sites. And there's more pyramids around the world than people know.
Well, it's fascinating because when you're in that area, and you were just in Bimini, it has a very rich history in this sense, which is that Casey predicted that we'd start to see a temple rising there, which was connected to these halls of records that the Atlanteans had placed in three different places, one in Egypt under the Sphinx, one in Bimini off the Poseidon temple buried, and one in Yucatan. So when he said it's going to raise, they said, when is it going to rise up? And he said, expected in 68 or 69, not so far away. So then you have this J. Manson Valentine, who is a Yale zoologist who's interested in the reading. He finds it. And there we have something which indicates there's a culture that was building these roads and walls sometime when that was above water. So it's very conclusive there in Bimini. You have kind of a psychic crossover from Casey's reading and archaeological standpoint. You can actually see it and take a look at it. Obviously, it's man-made.
Okay, but what's a Hall of Records? Okay, and I've said this. I said this in my talk on CPAC. I said, look, if we have past life memory now, and then we knew it was going to turn into such a disaster, and here we are, all telepathic, all, you know, many of us knowing how to do levitation and bilocation and all that Star Trek stuff, which were natural abilities if you had the transmutation of the atom, high level initiates. I mean, to me, this is just normal, right? And then all of a sudden we'd be dumbed down, as Hakim says in the Pyramid Code, from 360 senses to 5 senses. And we'd all be going, what? Okay, so we made deals. I'll see you there. Let's reincarnate at the same time. Okay, that'll be really important. Okay, so when I meet people, you know, I meet people and they say their name is Margaret. I'm like, that's not your name. But anyway, I knew them before, and we have cosmic appointments. And these people said, I got this really strange sense. I really know you. Well, this is also normal to me. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So we made a deal. Okay. We'll find each other, and we'll, in this massive darkness and corruption, we'll try to poke little holes of light through it all. Okay. And you said, okay.
Right.
See,
right,
see there. Okay. Like, to me, this makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Here we go. What would we have left for ourselves to trigger our ancient memories?
Good question.
Like, you and I and a bunch of other people on a committee had to design that. What would we leave? We would leave what's on the temple walls in India, the Sumerian tablets, the frescoes in Egypt.
Right.
Right? But now with our narrow thinking of, you know, patriarchy and power over and all that stuff, we look at this stuff and we don't know what we're looking at.
Right.
But there is a way to crack that, and we are cracking that. And part of that's in the Pyramid Code. Oh, they weren't very good with hands. No, they're trying to tell us something. Okay, what are they trying to tell us? And this goes on. I mean, there's a world of symbols, but they do tend to repeat over and over and over again. And then you look at a fresco, and you can make a sentence inside your head of this, and that, and okay, this is what they're trying to tell us. So people would come to me and say, well, interpret this for me. And I'd say, okay, look, I'm not going to be there when you're looking at your pictures. So how about I give you the vocabulary of the symbolism and you start to, you know, make a sentence for yourself out of what you're looking at. And if it doesn't make sense, then come and ask me what I think. Well, you should see how smart people get when you empower them in that way.
Wow.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. But to also empower them and say, you may have been part of this. What would you leave? What would we leave to trigger? And we do get triggered. So even the shape of the temples and each of the hypostyle halls have different cavities that reflect cavities in the human body. Schwaller de Lubitz did us a big favor. You know, the Holy of Holies is the pineal gland. Well, we better calcify that so that nobody can be psychic, right?
Yes.
So it's this whole big thing that it's been about. We'll never they all think we'll never figure it out.
Right.
Too late.
Yeah. Too late.
Too late. Too late. We figured it out. We didn't figure it all out, but we figured, I feel satisfied that we figured enough out.
Yes. Yes.
It was us.
It creates a rolling momentum is what you're describing, a cascading effect of information coming out. What's interesting to me is, and the question I wanted to ask you about being in Bimini, how do you feel when you're in Bimini? Casey laid a lot of emphasis on it as a major outpost of Poseidia, which is supposedly a major center of Atlantis, and that's where the temples were, the Poseidian temple. How does it feel when you're there? Do you sense anything?
Well, yes, I sense things. You know, sacred sites, sensing the sacred sites, that's kind of my thing, right?
Yes.
Now,
and I know you've been to so many.
Pardon me?
I know that you spent time at so many, so Bimini is interesting for me, how you felt when you were there.
66 countries, and Egypt counts as one. I've been there 35 times. I have been chasing around the world looking for little clues and little bits and pieces of this. Okay, so off the coast of Yanaguni, which is the north of Taiwan, and I did the beginning of my PhD research in Taipei, which there's a certain place on the road, you can see the bottom of Yanaguni.
Wow. Right there.
Or whatever the name of the island is. Okinawa, is that right? I think it is. Anyway, but Yanaguni is
really incredible ocean currents there too. Just
well, and Graham and Santa, you know, they did 54 dives each, if not more, but that's my number that I remember. And the person who went down and had trouble with his breathing apparatus and took one look and said, nah, it's natural. Well, if you really look, you can't say it's natural.
It's definitely not natural.
And in the Bimini Road, you can't say it's natural. You can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the when it kind of ends, you know, the blocks that would have made the rest of it are gone. You know, Malta, you've got these wagon tracks and they end and then the earth is gone. Well, you can't say that the wagon went nowhere. You know, the whole premise of people debunking and saying that none of this happened is they were all stupid and they made roads that didn't go anywhere. Well, let's not assume they were stupid.
Right, right, absolutely.
Absolutely, and so this is a unified field. These were our brothers and sisters and high-level initiates, priestesses and priests.
That's right. Oh, I think are you still there, Carmen? I think we may have lost you. You're there.
I'm here, but it seems like when I come to a crescendo, the thing goes off. Have you not happened before?
No question about it. Everyone, you're with us here on the Dark Journalist Show. We have Dr. Carmen Bolter, who is giving us a real deep overview of almost a preview of what's to come with her new Atlantis series that she's done. Of course, she did the incredible 5-part series on Netflix now, The Pyramid Code, which I think that came out now. It's about a decade ago. Which is remarkable for how many different countries.
It's pushing that, and it's not the same, you know, deal with getting editors and animators these days. So now I've got footage from 15 countries and counting before the end of the year. I hope to be completely out of production by the end of the year. And 15 countries.
Wow.
So by the time we go Malta, Crete, and Turkey, that'll be 3 more. So No, it's 16 with Russia.
And so you're bringing the New Atlantis series, the way that it is, and you're facing all sorts of hurdles. I mean, it's you're really working it out as you're used to doing. But you expect it to be available in 2020. That's when your target date is.
Well, it is. But the other thing is that what's very concerning is the Pyramid Code went straight to YouTube and millions, the people were making money off it and getting millions, yes. But I couldn't make anything off it. So, I mean, it's really a concern, but I did decide, okay, and I may end up finishing it myself. I'm doing the rough cut.
Uh-huh.
I'm the one with my camera, you know, like I never really thought that I would be the one that would have to figure it all out. But every time I get somebody to help me, they stand next to me and they say they really want to contribute. They over-aggrandize what they can do to help. And then they want me to give them $180,000 for it. It's like,
exactly.
I don't do this myself, you know?
Look, the behind the scenes on this is it's a very tough, tough thing to pull off, in fact. And to go to that many countries and to work with the sacred sites and bring forward these new things that you're trying to do, it's no easy task. So this is quite phenomenal what you're doing here. Your work, for people who want to follow it now, is at pyramidcode.online, and you can find most of it there. It's going to be at pyramidcode.com soon also. So for people who want to keep up with Carmen's work, that's where it's going to be. I guess what I want to ask you about New Atlantis and the documentary series. So let's say it's out sometime in 2020, if fingers crossed, if all goes well, you've been working on it. And it sounds like an extraordinary work. When you look at where we are in terms of our knowledge base about Atlantis, as it were, and there's been so many things to take us out of our center on that. Like you said, you know, think of it as a myth. Or, you know, here's this kind of sideways thing on the History Channel about Santorini is Atlantis because Plato was close by. What is the fundamental thing that we need to understand about this lost civilization, this lost chapter in our history, and how it relates to who we are now?
I'll tell you later.
That's what's called leaving it hanging. I like that.
But it isn't what you think, and and it's not where you think either. So
this is classic, Carmen. I know that when you are putting these things out and you have a major revelation, you don't want to leak it out, as it were. And I appreciate that. I guess let's think.
People don't believe it anyway because they haven't heard it before, and it wasn't on the news. So when you get, and I have told a few people, you know, in confidence,
uh-huh.
And they just like, I never heard of that. Well, that's the point. You never heard of it.
Well, let me do this.
You hear about it. Like when that whole thing with Hawara happened, people freaked out. Even the alternative media people.
Yes.
That can't be. I've never heard of it.
Yes.
That's a form of narcissism.
Yes.
It is. We don't expect to hear anything new. Because the news keeps recycling the same story day after day after day.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's incredible is, well, maybe we can back into this. Let's do it this way. Now, on this program, we've talked a lot about Paulina Zelitsky's find off Cuba, which was a massive site. And I feel that the mainstream media blocked the story very hard, and the alternative media didn't follow up on it properly. It became one of those, you know, clickbait things here once in a while. And she actually experienced a number of difficulties herself getting the story out and eventually just, you know, kind of retreated from it because it was such a hassle. And I'm sure you can relate to that. It's important to me with the kind of work that you do, how you see the find of Paulina Zelitsky off the coast of Cuba, of the massive underwater city and the ruins that she discovered there, and how that fits into this larger picture about Atlantis and what we might find.
Look at a map. Where's Cuba? Right there.
Yeah.
It's right there.
Yeah.
And look at Asia. I don't mean to be deviating here, but I studied the hill tribes that went Japan, Taiwan, Malaysia, you know, Philippines, Indonesia, all the way down to Tahiti, Easter Island, and New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. They all had the same symbols on their boats. They all wore feathers, red, white, and black. Well, maybe that was a unified field, and it wasn't a whole bunch of violence. Well, what about the Atlantic?
Right? What's the Bermuda Triangle? And how close off the coast of Cuba
to Bimini? I mean, if you fly enough and you look at a map, you'll see. I mean, from here, we went boating today. It could take 2 hours to get to Bimini from here in a boat.
Wow.
At the door. Okay?
That's more like it.
It's a little panhandle called Florida, but I think it was a unified field. I don't see any reason why, but it's very, very deep down there.
Mm.
Okay, and they had a lot of trouble when they were trying to figure out, you know, how to get down there and how to film it because the equipment didn't work. And you couldn't send a deep sea diver down there because it was too deep, right? So a lot of times people have underwater cameras. Pardon me, I'm not at home. Okay. Hey, it says ringer muted.
There we go. It's as live can get. Oh, you know, so what you're talking about over there, then the tongue of the ocean is right off Andros. So that's incredibly deep.
And where's Andros? Right, part of these 700 islands in the Bahamas that nobody realizes 700 islands because they just don't realize it. And so people jump to conclusions. I mean, it's extraordinary, but the other thing is there aren't 50 people who have seen it. Well, how are you going to get down there?
Right.
Who's going to lead the expedition and pay for it?
That's right.
And so, you know, like, does this person have credibility? And is photography real or not? And people can ridicule it. But, I mean, some things we just have to take at face value because of how the research was done, who did it, and what the pictures look like. But it doesn't fit with other things we've been told because we're used to this repetition. And even in terms of conversations that people have with each other now, you listen to how they're talking and you go, oh, they watch Fox. Oh, they watch CNN.
Right.
They read the New York Times. You know, and you can, because we've been taught as children in school to be parrots and repeat what the teacher says. So we've lost, and the creative thinking, forget that. Constructivism, making something cross-disciplinary, you know, different fields blending. No, everything is compartmentalized. Social anthropology doesn't speak to cultural anthropology. Nobody talks to anybody. And then the narrative comes that they repeat and repeat and repeat and people believe it. So if you come up with something that's different, you get ridiculed.
Right.
All the time. So, I mean, I don't want to talk to a lot of people because, you know, they just make fun of you.
Yes. Yes,
they're being smart because they watch the news.
Absolutely.
And I don't think the news makes people any smarter. I think it makes them, you know, repeat. And okay, so this is the answer to what I think about your question, because we need to think outside the box. We need to put ourselves inside the feeling of the answer and sense in and then look for verification. So sometimes these hunches come to me and it's 10 years before I can get verification.
Right.
But when it comes, I'm like, I knew that. And now someone else is saying it. But it's a hard road to hoe.
No question. No question at all. If you were to project out, say, over the course of the next 5 years, in terms of the discoveries that we'll make relating to Atlantis specifically, how would you visualize the information and the things that are emerging about this?
Well, you broke up there, so I'd like it if you repeated that question, please.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you were to look out over the course of 5 years and you were to imagine and visualize the things that we'll come to learn about Atlantis and this sunken lost civilization, what kinds of things come to mind that do you think that over the course of the next 5 years that we'll have?
I see more alternative researchers having ego about not having ego. I see them contradicting each other.
Uh-oh, I think we may have lost you. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to try a little backdoor thing. Everybody bear with me for a second. I'm going to try and relaunch this modem. So just bear with us for a second. Carmen, if you're there, you can talk away.
Oh, is it still live? Okay.
You are indeed.
Okay, so I see things deteriorating, not getting better. Having spoken at the same conference year in, year out, or, you know, over several years.
I think that is better. Okay.
Okay, I see contradictions in what people are saying.
I'm going to back this up, actually, because I'm going to ask you the question again for anyone who's just joining us on this. So over the next 5 years, in terms of Atlantis rising, how that might impact our consciousness, what we may find, what kind of discoveries would come forward. How do you see this? How do you see what we're going to know, say, 5 years from now versus where we are currently?
2024. Well, if we're still here, if geoengineering doesn't plow the planet apart, people can still think straight. I don't think people can think straight. The alternative people who are raising certain issues are arguing with each other. They have ego about not having ego. And I'm not kidding. You know, they want to be right. And the platform they stand on is I'm right because I said so.
Right.
So I'm not that optimistic because in the same fashion that, you know, different departments and disciplines don't speak to one another, presenters at the same conference don't speak to one another either. And so
yeah.
Cancel the panel on this one. And I understand why, because, you know, there's certain things that people don't want you to talk about past lives. They don't want you to be connected to a memory or know and then find evidence and say something that they never heard before. So I think we're becoming more and more conditioned to believe. And I've said all along, we don't have to believe it. Right. I'm not that optimistic that all of a sudden people will say, yep, that's it. Because you've got people from Antarctica telling you it's over here. You've got, you know, the Sphinx Hotel and the Atlantis restaurant over there. You've got the
sounds like a big kind of town, actually.
Yeah, but this, yeah, okay. But I mean, okay, and it's a nice idea, but just having spent, you know, an afternoon at the Atlantis, all that, it's
yeah, I like, agree with you.
Symbols. It's
a commercial exploitation of the idea. Yeah.
Yeah, no, but they all the symbols that they're showing, and first of all, they make things look really old, but then they're trying to modernize it. I was authenticity consultant for a spa in Calgary. I was authenticity consultant for the architect's office, and they had their plans, and they were just at the tail end, and so the structure was there. But, you know, how do they make the great room, and what do they put on the walls? And they were planning on, you know, having real frescoes, and well, I had the pictures. I was able to make overheads so that the, you know, they could paste the thing and carve them out. And, you know, there were all kinds of things. It's like, there's no black. There's no black in that. And they wouldn't have done that. And then they gave me some money to go to Egypt and buy artifacts and whatnot. But if they had just done what they wanted to do, the place would have looked like, you know, a version of Egypt that no one probably would have noticed wasn't authentic.
Right.
Okay, so at the Atlantis, you know, how are you going to decorate a place that's 9 hotels? I mean, they had flying horses and all kinds of interesting things that kind of fit with the legends. But the legends are kind of messed up. But what got me was the symbolism. So, they had weird symbols. Okay, and if you look at hieroglyphic, it's weird symbols. And if you look at runes or Sabian symbols, they look weird too. But they're a language. Right?
Right.
And so the symbols that they had, I mean, I took a picture of it. I thought, this just makes me feel funny. And my friend was there, and she goes, "That can't be accurate." I go, "That's what I was thinking, right?" And so, you know what I'm saying? Like, the people who are decorating these places may not be that conscious or that tuned in. So what are we going to see in 5 years? I don't know. And I hope that, you know, we can continue to put things together and come up with something reasonable. But I'm not overwhelmed with excitement that everyone's going to agree, because everybody wants to be right.
Right.
And if they haven't heard it, they're not going to buy it. And they sure don't want to buy your theory. You know, they want to have their own theory.
Right.
You know, so people stood up there talking about Göbekli Tepe. This is a north south axis. And the next guy comes up and says, this is an east west axis. And everybody just walked around, you know, and then he was talking about all this math stuff. And, you know, I just thought, oh, I just feel sick when I'm listening to this. And we sat down at lunch, and the lady said, did anybody feel stupid listening to him? And I thought, you know what? The job of the presenter is to empower the people.
Oh, yeah.
You end up feeling stupid at the end of it. The presenter didn't do a good job.
Right, absolutely.
And there's lots of that going on. So they blame themselves. Well, I didn't have as much education, and I haven't read as much as they have. And they instantly blame themselves for not understanding.
Amazing. Right. It's a great description. It really, this is what happens over and over again. One thing I think is that
even a child can see this is fake.
Well, let's look at it from the other side of the coin, which is, let's suppose there's some miraculous breakthrough. Like, let's say they find something in the hot zone, which is clearly like Zelensky's city, or let's say when you're 2020 New Atlantis documentary, that there's something in there that's undeniably Atlantean. What does that do when the culture takes that on? And, you know, let's suppose that the mainstream tries to keep it snuffed down. Why would the mainstream archaeological establishment and media establishment want to keep those things down? What's the threat exactly of understanding that there's an older advanced culture?
They're right. They're always right. Their academia doesn't want anything to be more than 5,000 years. I was going to do the PhD in archaeology. I did a year and spoke on the international speaker circuit because they changed things. If your undergrad wasn't the same, and my undergrad was psychology, that you had to do, you know, all the undergrad courses again. So I did. And during that year, speaking on the international speaker circuit, they let me speak, right? But then I realized... Okay. You can't tell a different story. You have to say Ramses was warring and cut the hands off of his enemies. And then even with the Anunnaki stuff, Enlil and Enki, well, they had a mother. They had Inanna. You know, they're doing all the patriarchal version of the Anunnaki, and their bodies lasted 450,000 years old. You know, years. You know, nobody cares if it adds up or not. So what happened with the pyramid code? First of all, most of the time when people watch something, there isn't very depth. There's not a lot of content. There's a little hearsay. There's some interviews. There's you know, some animations. And at the end, you feel mixed up. Mm-hmm. So I ended up with tens of thousands of emails from people, and I'm not inviting people to email me and say, yeah, you know, I felt really good watching that. You know, they didn't feel confused at the end. You know, when 8-year-olds are watching it and they understand it. Literally.
Yeah.
You know, and why shouldn't they? I mean, I've had 10-year-olds come on the trip, and they're the rock stars. They notice more. They see more. They understand it. And they're perceptive, and they're smarter than the rest of us, as far as I can see. You know, they're very, very astute. And we lose that as we get older. Like, a child can learn a language by the time they're 2, you know, and kids are very malleable. You know, maybe the kids will figure it out. But my point is that most people watch things and give up or say, I don't know, at the end. But with the pyramid code, they just felt inspired. And I mean, when you watch something on Netflix, do you find the director and tell them you liked it? You know, it's just like, it's just a weird phenomenon. So people felt good. Okay. So they took on what was there, but they felt like they already knew it, which I think is really interesting. Because if it's true, you kind of know. But the way everybody's afraid to make a mistake when they're learning a language, or there's a test and A, B, C, D, and what if I get it wrong? And they get all up nervous. But if we subscribe to this idea of almost knowing, you know, we would have a whole different field of people feeling confident to come forward and bring their little puzzle pieces. But we're still operating in that patriarchal world, you know, where somebody's right and somebody's wrong, and you know, somebody wins and somebody loses in the legal system, and the wrong guy goes to jail, and the, you know, the bad guy gets away with it. You know, even if somebody came out with it, and in fact, there's disclosure going on where files, UFO files are coming out. Is everybody walking around saying, hey, UFOs are real? They're not.
Right.
There's something about the way we've all been conditioned that seems to be preventing us from figuring anything out. Okay. But the pyramid code had an amazing impact in, you know, I don't know, 44 or 50 countries.
Oh, yeah.
You know, being translated into 9 languages and all that stuff. And too bad I didn't even make back 20% of what I spent on it. crazy way.
Well, this is an interesting question, actually, because you've spent some four decades opening this up. And it hasn't always, but you've faced a lot of hurdles with it. You've faced betrayals by large corporate entities. You've really encountered a lot of difficulty, but you've powered through. Now you're coming into New Atlantis 2020. What keeps you going through all these types of hurdles to get to the truth on this?
Well, the simple answer is I finish what I start. You know, because why put all this energy in if I'm not going to finish it?
Yeah.
You caught me when I was quite discouraged. You know, I lost my house over it.
Yes.
Moved to Spain, and, you know, the world seemed upside down. So
everything changed when you went to Spain. It's sort of like all kinds of wonderful things seemed to open up once you moved.
Well, how about the flights are closer?
Yeah, right. For starters.
It was a 4-hour flight to Russia. And the prices are reflected in that as well. So, and it's a completely different culture. And everybody's, oh, the EU's crashing and all that stuff. Don't believe it. You know, 5G, smart meters, GMOs, none of that. No fluoride in the water. It's an autonomous zone where I am. It's not toxic in the same way, in many ways, mentally even.
In Spain.
In Spain. It's just much healthier for me. Okay. But people are locked into all these beliefs, so it really feels good to be kind of outside that grid that just kind of forces everybody to think what they think. You know, I don't know that I'm that strong. I sure wasn't strong on Friday when my energy field was disheveled, and I didn't even know what to think anymore. I mean,
but that's part of it, isn't it?
It's what it would have sounded like if I'd come on.
That is part of it, though. This is overcoming these types of difficulties. It's part of the process, and part of that is energetic when you get right down to it. I mean, there's so many physical hurdles to it. There might be this person who doesn't sign off on it, or this government official who you need permission from to do a dig or whatever. But fundamentally, there's an energetic aspect to breaking through it all. That seems to be something that you seem to go back again and again, and that's a kind of persistence that's given you so many amazing results. In things like the Pyramid Code and now with New Atlantis 2020.
Well, and don't think the Pyramid Code was easy either, or Angels and Archetypes. I mean, I had 10 years of research into that book.
Right.
And couldn't make a penny on it. Other people can make $100 selling it secondhand, but I can't make a penny on it. And I'm not trying to do a sob story here because in Atlantis, we didn't even have money.
Right.
And so, you know, it was all
about this. Yeah.
Pardon me?
You've talked about this before where the people who are really from that, they're not always good with money in a sense, because Atlantis didn't use money. And there's like a kind of a weird thing about that.
Well, and the person with the highest consciousness was the ruler, if you will, but it was a collaborative learning. And it's almost like pilot to co-pilot, you know, that they would give the reins of governing or whatever the word, they wouldn't have even used that word. And the pilot's like feeling the co-pilot's feeling that I've done this. Sitting holding the plane myself. It's like, no, you do it. You know, but they would let, you know, people that they're mentoring feel the responsibility for a minute. And they went, okay, I get what you're doing now. But right. They didn't have the oldest, least healthy, most narrow-minded, single gender people with lobbyists telling everybody what to vote for. Like, right. We have completely lost the plot. Okay, as a culture.
Yeah.
And the idea of toxicity and, you know, like even cleaning products are toxic. Everything's toxic, you know, and so people are breaking down. But they can't think straight. There's something about being toxic in your body that makes your brain not work anymore. And all these influences, I mean, come on, I was in education all this time, educational psychology, you know, all of it. I worked as a psychologist for 35 years. You know, people get these beliefs and these core things. And so, in other words, I'm not that optimistic. And yet, on some level, I am because of the incredible success of the Pyramid Code, not financially, but certainly in terms of influencing people.
Oh, no question. Yeah, it's become a real benchmark for how people get knowledge when they're looking outside the box, on the archaeological side. I mean, everyone who's looking into that will run into the Pyramid Code, and it's quite unusual, I would say, as a video series. There's nothing really quite like it. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist program. We're here with Dr. Carmen Bolter. We're just going to ask her a few more questions. We're so lucky to have her. She happened to be down there in the hot zone in the Bahamas doing some filming for her New Atlantis special documentary series coming out in 2020. If you want more on Dr. Carmen Bolter and the work that she's doing, you want to go to pyramidcode.online. For now, you'll find a lot of information there about her series, her upcoming projects, and her tours of Egypt, which are absolutely fascinating. And then pyramidcode.com is where that's migrating to. So you might see that in a couple of weeks there. Carmen, before we go, I want to ask you, and this is really kind of, it's amazing to look back at this history you've had with Egypt and how it relates to this legacy culture that we know as Atlantis. Your first visit there to Egypt, this is 1977?
That's correct.
Wow, amazing. When you look back on that journey coming there, and I remember you saying that it seemed very familiar to you and when you were kind of working your way around, in terms of destiny, how important does that trip feel?
Well, I found a picture in one of my father's books of the Sphinx and started planning to go to Egypt when I was 12. And the first thing I did when I got there was kick my shoes off. And then I learned, you know, 20 years later that the initiates never wore shoes in the temples. I wanted to be inside the Great Pyramid. And this young kid that was Egyptian brought me in there. When I first saw it, I said, oh, that pyramid's not big enough. How do you mean it's the Great Pyramid? Well, it turns out it was 30 feet bigger on every side. It's the Great Pyramid. It's like, well, it's not big enough. We went, what are you talking about? It's the Great Pyramid. I didn't believe him anyway. So we spent 3.5 hours in there, and there were apparitions in my pictures. So I get back. I'm 20-something. And take my camera to the camera store and say, can you tell me what's wrong with my camera? And they opened it up and looked, and they said, nothing. So, well, what's that pink and green stuff in the pictures? Right. So I was already picking up on apparitions.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Lova. She had apparitions in her pictures from way back when. So when she started telling her story and showing me these pictures, I went, she was there just like me. She existed in the same way. Like I had never met another myself until a couple of weeks ago, right? That had that same kind of, you know, drive and memory. So I was riveted on it. I mean, if you think I was riveted before the trip, I mean, I couldn't leave it alone after that.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's my own cosmic appointment, my own agreement to, I mean, of course, this is all past life stuff. So, you know, like, and lots of people think they want to go to Egypt. Of course, they do want to go to Egypt. But when they, you know, get a traditional guide who starts talking about the warring and, you know, and the slaves built the pyramids and all that stuff. I mean, I stood beside guides that talk like that. It makes me want to feel like passing out, right?
Yes.
And so, like, if you really have a sense about Egypt, I think you should be careful who you go with.
Yes.
You know, it's going to add you more than, you know, comfort you. And that's the other thing about the sailing trip. I mean, okay, do you know how many people are in Cairo? How many people live in Cairo?
Excellent question.
94 million.
Unbelievable.
Three times the population of Canada now in one city, which makes modern Egypt completely chaotic. And, you know, the people are just getting driven down and driven down and driven down. You know, when I used to go, when it was a fixed rate, it was one American dollar, 3.14 Egyptian pounds. Now, 18 Egyptian pounds to the dollar. So their money's not worth anything. You know, they're all a little bit desperate. And so this sailing trip gives us our own company and the quiet of the way it used to be. And I was getting a little bit fed up with, you know, the way the modern Egyptians were making things tough. So.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, that first
That's
trip.
That's fascinating. This trip sounds amazing. So, yeah, there's no question. Of course I do. I can't believe it.
One of my friends was on the chat line. I talked to him yesterday. He says, I think maybe Daniel and his friend are going to come. I'm like,
That's a good psychic impression right off the bat. You know what's amazing is this would be the trip, because let's just give someone an idea of doing this. You go out and it's 2 weeks basically that you're out there, and because you're sailing, you're able to access these places that when you're doing traditional Egyptian trips, you're not going to find. And because you have this 4 decades of experience with Egypt, you know where those sites are, and you will work also from this esoteric point of view, you know where the real sites are, which is a whole different matter than just finding the traditional, you know, Ramses II is over here, which is great and all. But there's actually kind of almost like a transformative aspect to this. If you're really ready to open up to what mystical Egypt is all about, there you are in Carmen's trip.
Well, and it is a live pyramid code. Like I was doing these trips, and that's how the pyramid code ended up happening. Okay. Hakim was my mentor for 10 years, and he showed me a lot of the sites on the Band of Peace. But about 4 days after the pyramid code was on in Egypt, it was on in the Middle East and North Africa with a proper Arabic soundtrack, they closed Abu Ghraib. Abu Roush was never open. And so really what's motivated this trip is people who were on the last trip who went, well, I want to go here and I want to go there, and we didn't do this. And I want time at the temples where there aren't a lot of people around. And so I don't know how many right now, but I think something like 6 people from the last trip have already registered for this one.
That's fantastic.
And that was a year ago. That, is that right? No, it was 6 months ago. But anyway, so these people say, well, we want to go to Abu Ghraib. And I'm like, well, I don't know. You know, and the tour company's like, no, let's close. And we want to walk on the floor of the Assyrian. Okay, I'll see if we can get a permit. You know, and we have to think what we can and can't do. And even the sailboat company is like, well, what if there isn't enough water when we want to go up to Kenna, which is close to Dendera, or Sohag, which is up close to Abydos. And it's like, okay, well, maybe we just have to put a caveat on that, you know, if the Nile dries up, we can't go and we'll take a bus. But, you know, and, you know, we don't know if we'll be able to get up to Abu Roush, but I've got my ways and I got my people that can get us up there, even if we're in 10 taxis, you know, and we're going to try to do these sites that, you know, no one goes to. Including the pyramid at Dahshur. And now you can get into the Bent Pyramid. We can buy a ticket to get in the Bent Pyramid for the first time ever.
Wow.
The only one who has the keys to certain places, and finally they decided to add a place. Because for them, archaeology is moving the entrance and the exit and putting fences around things.
Right. Well, you're the one who tells everyone that when they do the King Tut exhibit, it's actually a replica. It's not the real one that's moving around.
Oh, but you want to talk about King Tut now. They say the new museum's open and they're moving the King Tut stuff over. And it's just an abandoned construction site with no road into it. Are you really going to take the world's treasures and put them into an unsecure place? No, with no road. No. Okay, so they published in a newspaper in Norway that my friend saw and said, oh, it's open and it's free to the public until February. We drive past it. You see, they're maybe working on it. There's big holes in it, right? I got pictures. Yeah. Okay, so they said they moved. So the King Tut stuff is, you know, slowly, slowly ending up not in the National Museum. Well, they're moving it to the new one. So then the guide last time said, oh, I'm so upset. This is before the trip. I'm like, what are you upset about? Oh, did you hear about the fire? I'm like, what fire? Well, they moved the King Tut stuff, and then there was a fire, and all the King Tut stuff burned. I'm like, what? You believe that?
Wow.
They're selling it on the open market. They're making replicas and putting the replicas in the museum. You can see the places where they have the, you know, the outline of where the jewelry was in the King Tut exhibit is lighter, darker where the thing was. And they're just taking this stuff out of there. It is
unbelievable. Well, papyrus. You're an excellent point, which is that there's an incredible black market for archaeological items and artifacts, that especially Egyptian stuff, that has to be the top. And that drives a lot of the conversation that we hear about here. And also, I want to make this point about when we see things about National Geographic specials and stuff and the people that they choose to do this, that's all quite the network. And, you know, it's quite the clicky little setup, and they have to all talk the same language. And you talked about this when they were doing the Nefertiti DNA and all that, and it took 12 years to figure out, oh, no, it wasn't her. But in the meantime, they got a heck of a lot of good television specials out of it. So it's very important who you look at this information with. And Carmen, your work, I've always found such great you know, it's interesting to me because I think incorporating that intuition that you have and the experience that you have there makes everything that you do very unique when it comes to ancient Egypt. The idea of you around this New Atlantis, and again, this New Atlantis series coming out in 2020, and the work that I know you've put into it, and we've talked behind the scenes about this for a long time. I know you've been really struggling to get this out and do it right, which is another thing that makes things like the Pyramid Code so brilliant. You're not just going to go in there and say, well, you know, I'll slap a soundtrack on there and get it out. You're going to find the people who can play the music from these periods and all the rest. I think this is very important to capturing it. So this is what you're doing, and that's why you bring this very authentic spirit to all the work that you do for ancient Egypt. The site, everyone, is pyramidcode.online, and it's going to pyramidcode.com to keep up with Dr. Carmen Bolter's work. Extraordinary, Carmen, and it's always a blast to see you, and I mean a mystical blast, and also it's just great to see you.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I don't mean to be, you know, candid or bold or critical, but yes, I've come upon what I know the hard way.
No, I think actually putting it where it is, that's the kind of transparency that we need around this. I think as long as we have you, I think that you're opening things up in the hot zone. Once I knew you were down there, I knew we were getting somewhere.
It's all, like I keep saying, cosmic appointments or, you know, it's all very interesting how it all happens. You know, I was at the Pacific Ocean. I did an Indian Ocean. Here I am swimming in the Atlantic.
Yes.
So it's like, who's orchestrating all this? I just feel like, you know, I'm being sent places. Yeah, with magic money.
With magic money.
My favorite prayer is handle it. If you want me to do it, figure out how I'm going to do it. But to me, magic's normal. My trips are called Magic Egypt.
Yes.
I think we're all supposed to be working with magic. But that just became something, you know, in a cartoon. But I think that that's our birthright.
I want to follow up on something real quick here. And that's an excellent point, because you have to be tuned into it in the first place in order to arrive there. So you have to have that room in your mind to open up to it. You've worked... And we'll close out on this, but you've worked extensively around this project involving the tomb of Alexander the Great. I just want to know if there's any kind of update you can share with us, and that's an ongoing. I know it's tricky, and it's been an ongoing. Like when that comes out, it's major. But if there's anything you can share with us about it, that'd be great.
Okay, same stew, different gravy. It's the same thing. Something is discovered. And then the government comes to shut it down.
Uh-huh.
Because they asked me to be expedition manager. And I went and met all the principals and the discoverer in Paris last year. And they said, you know, they had it ongoing. And then all of a sudden, there was no information about it. But they had me sign a gag order. And they asked me to cancel my schedule. And then I'm like, well, but what did I cancel it for? What are we doing? Oh, we can't tell you. The king of Jordan has to decide. So, but the thing is, now that I've got five different expeditions that I was supposed to go on that all got kind of sideways shut down, again, I think that's the playbook. So wow. I believe it's there. It's three stories in Jordan, not on the Silk Road, not beside Petra. It's in an abandoned salt mine. And there's a lot of stuff down there. And I've seen pictures. And... you know, credible people, it seems, are involved. It's bigger than King Tut. It's almost 100 years to the day from finding King Tut. That was November 1920 or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's a world treasure. It's everybody's.
And I have to say that when we look back on, you know, we know it is Howard Carter's find of King Tut, that the discovery of that, it really did impact the culture. And when they did send this imitation Tut on tour in America and all the rest, if you look back at that, it really seems like every show was picking up this idea of the King Tut exhibit, and it really had this major impact. It's almost like a memory back there getting sent off. And you've noted this before with Nefertiti, which is, we're still talking about these people so many thousands of years later. There's a reason for that.
Well, because they were wise ones. And, you know, they had, you know, funny shaped hat covers funny shaped head. They had the extended pineal glands. They had the abilities, and that was normal to them. And we have the same DNA as they have. But we don't know that, you know, if we don't use our muscles, we, you know, atrophy is...
I have to ask, does Akhenaten come up in your New Atlantis special at all?
Yes.
That's great. Well, this is one we're really looking forward to, as well as your travels in the hot zone. I really want to hear all about that. So we're going to have to catch up tomorrow. I know that you're taking a flight out of here tonight.
I am. I'm going back to Spain to my long-haired four-leggeds, my horse and my little dog.
Fantastic. Well, we know they've missed you, but I'm glad we were able to connect even after this whole thing with you coming out of Nassau and everything that happened there on Friday. It's fantastic that we broke through that and you came back strong so much. And everyone here is so happy. I can tell you on Friday after the show was over, there were so many people who were like, is there anything you can do to get Carmen on? Because they really wanted, knowing that you were surfacing there, they really wanted to hear everything that you had going on. And they were not disappointed to hear from you today. I can tell you that. Great to see you. Again, it's pyramidcode.online. And we'll be looking for more of what you're doing. And please, definitely, if anyone, if you're interested in that trip with Carmen going to Egypt in March, don't procrastinate on that. And you know, apathy won't be it because they go quick. I can tell you from experience. And unbelievable, Carmen. Thank you so much. It's great to see you.
Good to see you too. Thank you.
Fantastic. And we'll talk soon.
Okay, let's do it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow, incredible. And incredible to see Dr. Carmen Bolter with us. Unbelievable New Atlantis information for everyone. And that documentary is coming out on, well, you know, it's interesting how long she's been working on this. So it's going to be a real treasure when it hits as a documentary series. And she is putting the finishing touches on it now. Everyone, it's great. We had this impromptu show this afternoon. So many people showed up, and this really can be called part two of X Series 69, which is where we were working on this whole Atlantis-Egypt connection. And it just so happened that Carmen was working in the hot zone. What great synchronicity. It's great to see everyone out there. Carly from Dimensions and Beyond, thank you so much. And of course, Groovy Bean. Jumping in there because we didn't have Olivia because she was not, we didn't know the show was even coming up. So we weren't able to take your questions, but for sure next Friday we'll be back with a new show and Olivia will be here. And it's fantastic to see everyone. Breach, excellent to see you. Kate, Bo Krills, thank you very much. Jason, Frank, it's fantastic to see everyone out there. So many great familiar faces in the chat tonight in what I call the ideas room because we spread so many of those ideas. And I can tell you, just speaking about the X series in general, the work of people like Carmen Bolter really bring in that mystical Egypt, really bring in that hot zone Atlantis understanding of the whole situation. And so we very much appreciate their work. And when they come out, and when they come forward with their work, it's, you know, we really need to support them because that's how we're going to get the good information. So we get all these kind of like gobbledygook movements with the CIA paying off, you know, the Tom DeLonge movement for phony UFO disclosure and things like that. All those things grab the TV shows and the headlines. But what we need is the really good, solid people like Dr. Bolter. And all of the great people that we have here on the show for you. We'll be back on next Friday. Get your space caps on because we're going into deep space next Friday at 8 p.m. for the X Series Part 70. And have a fantastic Sunday afternoon. It's been great to see you. And we'll see you all on Friday. So thank you very much. And have a great weekend. And thank you to the moderators who came out and helped with today's show, as it was very impromptu. But boy, what a gem of a show it has been. And my deepest thanks to Dr. Carmen Bolter and her mystical Egypt work, along with her great series, The Pyramid Code, and her upcoming series called New Atlantis. This is the one that we need. And I do feel that there is a breakthrough in that series, which really dovetails so well with the work that has been coming up in the Hot Zone episodes here on the X series. So thank you very much, everyone. It's great to see your faces out there and have all your comments. We will see you next Friday. And of course, we end the broadcast, but you know, it never really ends.